proudly presents the Tom Hartman Program. Welcome to the No Boring Zone.
What's it going to take? What's it going to take for us to realize that stupid white men are trashing our nation, our world, and our planet? Greetings, my friends. Tom Hartman here with you. Our phone number, 866-303-2270, tomhartman.com and airamerica.com. If you want to drop into our live chat room at tomhartman.com, just click live chat up at the top of the page, Air America. Click on our link to go to the Tom Hartman page, and you'll find the chat room link where we hang out during the show. What's it going to take for us to realize that stupid white men are trashing our nation, our world, and our planet? I do not mean this as a rhetorical question. Bill O'Reilly and John McCain last night.
Do you understand, and I'm not saying this in a condescending way, you're smarter than I am, sure. But do you understand what the New York Times wants and the far left want? They want to break down the white Christian male power structure, of which part, and so am I, and they want to bring in millions of foreign nationals to basically break down the structure that we have.
Oh, my God, they're going to bring in brown people to take over America from the white Christian males. I mean, you get this? And then McCain agrees with him.
In that regard, Pat Buchanan is right. So I say that you've got to cap it with a number.
In America today, we have a very strong economy, low unemployment. So we need additional foreign workers, including, by the way, agriculture.
Now, this is McCain's trying to make his economic argument. We need slave labor, you know. We need cheap labor. It's profitable for the corporations. But O'Reilly brings it back to race.
But there may come a time where we have an economic downturn, and we don't need so
okay,
many.
But in
so
this,
I think it has to vary.
In this bill, you guys got to cap it. Because you're estimating there's 12 million. There may be 20.
Yeah.
You don't know. I don't know.
Oh, my God.
You
got to
cap it.
We do. We do. I agree with you.
Yeah. Good old John McCain. Yes, it is. We have to, you know, be very, very concerned that the...
But do you understand what the New York Times wants and the far left want? They want to break down the white Christian male power structure, of which part, and so am I.
Of which you are a part, and so am I. Indeed. Ruth Bader Ginsburg, in a Supreme Court decision, this is a day before yesterday, Supreme Court once again ruled by the thinnest of margins, this in the Washington Post, that workers may not sue their employers. This is specifically, in this case, it dealt with a woman, but it could also deal with other minorities. May not sue their employers over unequal pay caused by discrimination alleged to have occurred years earlier. The decision moved Justice Ruth Bader Ginsburg, this is Robert Barnes' piece in the Wall Street Journal, the decision moved Justice Ruth Bader Ginsburg to read a dissent from the bench, a usually rare practice that she has now employed twice in the past 6 weeks to criticize the majority for opinions that she said undermine women's rights. She said, in our view, the court does not comprehend or is indifferent to the insidious way in which women can be victims of pay discrimination. Last month, she rebuked these five same white men. We are talking here of the five white male Catholics on the bench. Stevens, Souter, those on the other side. Roberts, Kennedy, Scalia, Thomas, and Alito. She was joined by Stephen Souter, Breyer, and Ginsburg, the other four. Three of them are, you know, white males. Three of them are white Christian males, for that matter, I believe. No, Breyer is Jewish. So here we have a little bit of diversity on the other side saying, hey, wait a minute, let's stand up for diversity. And then you got these, Clarence Thomas isn't a white guy. In any case, he's voting with them. And in the context of the Bill O'Reilly thing. This war on women, and where I want to take this, by the way, is directly to Cindy Sheehan and what has happened to her. There's a fascinating post over on Democratic Underground yesterday, how women activists are silenced. This is posted by L.W. Fern, and over at Democratic Underground. And a tip of the hat to you, whomever you may be, for posting this, for pulling out several different pieces from the Guardian and from other sources. Sierra had been receiving increasingly abusive comments on her website, creating passionate users, that's the name of the website, over the previous year. But she had not expected them to turn so violent. Her attackers not only verbally assaulting her, F off, you boring, you know, this language I'm reluctant to even say on the radio. I hope someone slits your throat. This was a quote that was, but also posting photo montages of her on other sites, one with a noose next to her head and another depicting her screaming with a thong covering her face. Since she wrote about the abuse on her website, the harassment has increased. She said, people are posting all my private data online everywhere, social security number, home address, retaliation for speaking out. The post goes on to say, while no one could deny that men experience abuse online, the sheer vitriol directed at women has become impossible to ignore. Extreme instances of stalking, death threats, and hate speech are now prevalent, as well as all the everyday harassment that women have traditionally faced in the outside world. Catcalls, for example, are being raided on their looks. Jill Filipovic, a 23-year-old law student who also writes on the popular blog Feministe, recently had some photographs of her uploaded and subjected to abusive comments on an online forum for students in New York. She said the people who were posting comments about me were speculating as to how many abortions I've had, and they talked about hate blanking me, said Filipovic. I don't think a man would get that. The harassment of women is far more sexualized. Men may be told they're idiots, but they aren't called whores. One website run by law professor and occasional New York Times columnist Ann Althaus devoted an entire article to how I was posting so as to make breasts as obvious as possible. The post, titled, Let's Take a Closer Look at Those Breasts, ended up with over 500 comments. Most were about my body, she writes, my perceived whorishness, and how I couldn't possibly be a good feminist because I had the gall to show up at a meeting with my breasts in tow. And I can tell you, I get my share of hate mail and death threats. Tom Dwyer, the local auto guy here in Portland, took 3 bullet holes out of my car. God bless him. But it is not at the level, first of all, it's not sexualized, which for women carries a whole additional level of threat. And this is why this, for example, Michael Savage talking about Barbara Walters.
Notice what this double-talking slut just did, this mind slut, Barbara Walters. And I stick by those words. She's an empty mind slut. She'd peddle anything for a ratings point. That mental prostitute, Barbara Walters. It sickens me. I think that the woman is vermin. I think she's dirt.
So not just attacking a person for their opinions, not just attacking a person for what they say or how they say it, but instead attacking them for their gender and using that as a tool, as a wedge. Rush Limbaugh.
I have long told you, for example, Undeniable Truth of Life number 24, written back in 1987, feminism was established so as to allow unattractive women easier access to the mainstream of society. And even to this day, people poo-poo this and say it's insensitive. How could you possibly say something like that? Well, because I mean it, because I believe there's something to it.
Yeah. So men, regardless of whether they're attractive or not, should have the right to say anything and speak out and should be able to get good jobs and should have equal pay. But women, only if they're pretty, apparently. And again, here's Michael Savage on Diane Sawyer.
Why they say they're doing
whore.
What they're doing. Even
you
your
lying whore.
Teach you something about why they are doing what
you
they're doing.
Lying
and
whore.
We're trying to bring back real information in this critical time for these people who live in that part of the world. It is so complicated.
You're full of crap. Who do you think you're fooling? I don't know how this goes on in this country, that a witch, a whore like Diane Sawyer, and I'm going to stick to those words, to me, she's a whore.
See, this is the sexualization of one class of people. These kind of words would never be directed at a man. And Cindy Sheehan has been on the receiving end of an enormous amount of this, which I want to share with you after we come back from a break in just a minute. But it continues. I mean, this is it just goes on and on and on. For example, Limbaugh had his testicle lockbox ad. This is appealing to the fears of men, right?
Ladies, are you fed up with men calling the shots? Are you looking for a new weapon in the war of the sexes? If you need the Hillary Clinton testicle lockbox, you can finally grab the power that's keeping Hillary Clinton safe from tough media questions.
Yeah, you need the Hillary Clinton testicle lockbox. Come on, I mean, once again, because she's a woman. Where's the Fred Thompson tech? Come on. 16 minutes past the hour. Tom Hartman here with you.
The Tom Hartman Program. Transforming the world by revitalizing democracy. This is Air America Radio.
What's it going to take for us to realize that stupid white men are trashing our nation, our world, and our planet? And the occasional minority male gets in there as well. Anne Wright. This, again, back to this Democratic Underground posting by L.W. Fern. She's this quoting bitingbeaver.blogspot.com. Both of these predate the recent issue with Cindy Sheehan. I saw Anne Wright speak last night. She said Cindy was also getting these sort of emails, the kind that are reminiscent in tone of lynchings. Those that not only disagree with her position, but spew misogynistic hate speech and threats at her. Every day her inbox was flooded with these. Her friends had convinced her to stop reading her email. There's a very special kind of hatred reserved for women who speak out. It's ugly to witness on Democratic Underground. I witness it here every day as well as every other blog I visit, with a few notable exceptions. It doesn't matter whether those blogs are political in nature or tied to graphic design. It just doesn't matter. It targets women who are Republicans, who are Democrats, who are spouses, pundits, independents. From Laura Bush to Janet Reno to Chelsea Clinton to Ann Coulter. And, you know, and it goes on. And what I'm getting at is that Cindy Sheehan is not unique. This is part of a system. It's a system that encourages men and women on all sides of the political offenses to attack women as women, to threaten them, to demean them as women, in order to get them to shut the hell up. Now, it continues. I mean, Sean Hannity.
Are far too promiscuous today, and there has been a change in value.
Women are far too promiscuous today. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Thank you, Sean. And in fact, we should die in order to prevent a woman from being Speaker of the House, as Hannity would
say. This is the moment to say that there are things in life worth fighting and dying for, and one of them is making sure Nancy Pelosi doesn't become the Speaker.
Yeah, to the best of my knowledge, Hannity's not dead, so apparently he was just, you know, empty words here. But nonetheless, it just goes on and on and on about the.
They want to break down the white Christian male power structure.
And it even extends a little beyond women. For example, Tommy Heffelfinger. He was a tough, clean cut, square jawed Republican prosecutor. One of the federal attorneys, this is from the L.A. Times, one of the federal attorneys that was kicked out, he showed up on the list. Why? Part of the reason, according to the Los Angeles Times, government documents and other evidence suggest, is that he tried to protect voting rights for Native Americans. You see, they're not part of the white Christian male power structure. At a time when GOP activists wanted U.S. attorneys to concentrate on pursuing voter fraud cases, Heffelfinger's office was expressing deep concern about the effect of a state directive that could have the effect of discouraging Indians in Minnesota from casting ballots. Citing requirements in a new state election law, Republican Secretary of State Mary Kiffmeyer directed that tribal ID cards could not be used for voter identification by Native Americans living off reservations. Heffelfinger, this is the prosecutor and his staff, feared that the ruling could result in discrimination against Indian voters. Many do not have driver's licenses or other forms of ID beyond the tribe's photo IDs. The Times adds, the Los Angeles Times, about 3 months after Heffelfinger's office raised the issue of tribal ID cards and non-reservation Indians, in an October 2004 memo, his name appeared on a list of U.S. attorneys singled out for possible firing. Why? because he's not standing up for the white male Christian Republican power structure. And without, and not standing up for that, well, you know, we can't have that, right? And if a woman dares to speak back to, you know, Bill O'Reilly, for example, this is Colonel Ann Wright, right? A colonel in the military.
Do want to make sure the Iranians treat people properly, and I want to make sure the United States treats people properly.
Sure you do.
I surely do. That's what I spent 29 years of my life trying to do.
You know what happened to you? Somewhere along the line.
Very important.
All right. Somewhere along the line.
I served 29 years. How many did you serve?
Where did you teach the Geneva Convention? Cut her mic off. Goodbye.
Cut her mic off. Goodbye. I mean, you know, this is just, that's the classic, that's the whole classic case here.
When she came in, they changed the format. They made it more like a morning news show.
It's Michelle Malkin.
It was a bad idea.
About Katie Couric.
So they corrected that now, and she's still getting hammered.
And she said, she came in, it was already the lowest rated of the three broadcasts.
She's doing worse than
Chica. I know that she's doing worse, Bill, but the point is, she didn't inherit some really successful show.
Is this a woman's thing?
No, I don't think that.
Do you think a woman's going to be accepted in that role?
I think it's a Katie Couric thing. I don't think it's a woman thing. I think that we have to see whether or not.
I think it's a woman thing.
How can you prove that?
Okay, excellent question, Powers, because I can prove it. Connie Chung, Barbara Walters, and now Katie Couric. It's a woman's thing, Michelle. You got 30 seconds. It's an authority position. Most middle Americans who watch news feel comfortable with men in that position. That's what's going on. Go ahead.
I think it's an information revolution thing.
I hate to find myself agreeing with Michelle Malkin, but here's Bill O'Reilly going, Katie, you can't have a newscaster who's an actual woman. Can't have that. And to what extent has Cindy Sheehan's decision to leave the movement been based on the fact that so much of the abuse that's been directed against her has been because she's a woman and a mother, rather than just another male activist? 27 minutes past the hour. Your call's next.
Exposing the con in conservative. This is the Tom Hartman Program on Air America Radio.
Thirty-four minutes past the hour. You see, if you ask a man who he is, odds are he'll say, I'm a stockbroker. He'll describe his job. It's unlikely that he'll say, I'm my son's dad or I'm my wife's husband. It's you know, it's a cultural thing. I mean, it's acculturation. And because of that, because we've had a 26-year war on working people, which has largely hit working men in the United States, you got a lot of really frightened, really insecure men out there right now. And, you know, so a lot of them are joining the military and becoming even more frightened and more insecure, given everything that's going on in Iraq. And so Bush and Rove have effectively used 9/11 as a substitute for job anxiety. And the war in Iraq, a symbolic way for men to vicariously feel personal power via their stand-in, this macho guy in the White House, right? At the same time, Limbaugh and this vast conservative talk machine are working overtime to assure the underemployed and threatened men of America that the target of their rage should not be conservative policies, but instead castrating women. Hillary's behind the campaign to put men's testicles in a lockbox. It's those damn liberals who are responsible for all the ills that have befallen the working class, right? And you get Joe Lieberman out there trying to out-testosterone Bush. Yeah, we got to kill even more people. And on the Republican debate, well, you know, I'd put I'd have 10 more Guantanamos. My Guantanamo is bigger than your Guantanamo. I mean, you know, come on. In the meantime, BBC reports that under conservative governments, they did an analysis of this, under conservative governments in the United Kingdom, which tend to increase unemployment and decrease wages, suicide of men goes up measurably. They said in the 20th century, over 30,000 men committed suicide who wouldn't have, during conservative rules, that when the government flipped liberal, those are the words that they used, you know, it's Labor and Tory, but when the government flipped liberal, the men were committing suicide at a much lower rate. They had decent jobs. David in San Francisco, California. Hey, David, welcome to the program.
Yeah, how are you, Tom? You know, I wanted to raise this in you as a historian, probably are well aware of the blend issues before World War II, Adolf Hitler had sent thousands of propagandists into many countries, including America, and was working actively to break down the united aspects of every country. And since America was founded on the issue of united you stand, divided you fall, and if you look at what you've been describing and playing this morning, it's solely based upon dividing and conquering. And so this whole idea of women are the problem, form of politics or this form of sexuality are the problem. And so it's always these Bund organizations. If you find a kind of a well-published book from World War II days called Undercover by John Roy Carlson, you read all of the phrases that you're describing today are identical. I mean, to the phrase, identical to what the Bund was doing pre-World War II. And they were just trying to soften up America before the takeover. And so, you know, I'm always suspicious of these guys when they're using the exact phrases.
I saw a propaganda piece that was made by the House Un-American Activities Committee. It was the first time Congress had ever actually made a movie, and it was made in, I think, 1950. And I watched it on the web a couple of days ago, or over the last weekend. And it started out with footage from one of those Bund meetings in 1936 or 37, I think it was, where you had a room full of men, and they were all wearing swastikas on their arms, and the stage was covered with American flags, and they were all carrying American flags in one hand, and they had their arm out salute, the Hitler salute, as they recited the Pledge of Allegiance to the United States.
Right.
I mean, that was the whole Bund movement, or not the whole Bund movement, but part of it. You know, the Nazi part of it, trying to integrate Nazism into America. That was one of the problems that Roosevelt had. I mean, you know, he had the Nazis on the far right, and he had the Stalinists basically on the far left, and he was trying to walk down the middle. But that's a whole other discussion.
Sure.
David, thank you. Good point and well made. Judy in Dana Point, California. Hey, Judy.
Hi, Tom. Thank you for taking my call. What amazes me about this these men is that they're spouting all this hatred. And to me, I sit back and I look at the fanatical Muslim religion and the fanats in that religion. They're the same. They're exactly the same.
This is the Taliban.
Exactly.
This is the Christian Taliban, the American Christian Taliban.
That's exactly what I meant to say. And I just can't understand how they can not listen to themselves and spew the same hatred.
I think just like the Taliban, they believe it. They really, you know, they're so frightened, they're so insecure about their position and their role in society and in the world that they feel that it's self-defense.
And these men are just little cowards, and they need to have that power structure, and they need to feel that they're above everything, and because they're cowards, they're just really frightened little men.
Yeah, well said, Judy. Thank you very much. Bernice in Santa Fe, New Mexico. Sorry, Judy, about that. Bernice in Santa Fe, New Mexico. Hey, Bernice.
Good morning, Tom. My question concerning this last issue is, how is it that Michael Savage and Bill O'Reilly, why are they still on our airwaves for these kinds of horrific things they say about our, you know, leaders, our women leaders?
Because that's what's expected of them. The difference in my, you know, I may be wrong on this, but in my opinion, the difference between these guys and Don Imus, who recently got bounced off for his sexist, racist comment, is that Don Imus was not a professional hate monger. And these guys are professional hate mongers. They call it entertainment, and everybody expects it.
Well,
people tune into their shows, and that's what they expect. They expect expect hate mongering, and so you know they do it with impunity, and everybody goes, "Oh yeah, that's right wing entertainment."
Right. Well, I don't expect the FCC or something to kick them off. I just think maybe we as consumers ought to talk about this a little more. But
by and large, yeah, good point, Bernice, and thank you. By and large, what's happening is that the ratings for right wing talk radio are declining. The ratings certainly for Fox News are declining. So I think that increasingly Americans aren't buying this anymore. But this is psychological warfare of the first order. It really and truly is. And as underemployed and unemployed, in particular men, and in particular white men, since they're the majority in the United States, become more and more nervous about their economic viability and their position in society, then this is going to continue. It's going to get worse. Mike in Burien, Washington.
Hey, Tom, how you doing?
I'm fine. What's up, Mike?
Well, those federal judges, just like Cheney, Bush, any of them, can be impeached. And this is what bothers me the most of this attack, not only on workers' rights, but women's rights for certain, is the white noise from our elected officials. Where is the Democratic leadership that stuck up for the damn people of this country? That's what got them there.
I know. And that's what we thought we were electing, and we need to be holding these guys accountable, and we need to be talking back to them. You need to be, you know, calling your elected officials and inviting them to come to town meetings, and if they don't do them, set one up and say, okay, we're going to set up a town meeting, we're going to advertise it, you can show up if you want or not. If you don't, I'll speak. You know, not me, Tom Hartman, but you as the organizer. But invite your elected officials to come and participate. Bob in Detroit, Michigan. Hey, Bob, listening on WDTW.
Hi, Tom. I guess my problem with the venom that's coming out of this right-wing pundit's mouth is, you know, not. I mean, this shouldn't be a women thing or a man thing, but evidently, I mean, their big problem with women who don't disagree with them, I mean, it's just flat out disgusting. I mean, what's next? Are they looking to strip women of citizenship who don't agree with them? Is that
well?
Is
they,
that
you know, we did. We did for the first 100 years of the station. Yeah, they were not allowed to vote. I mean, you know, Tom DeLay and Newt Gingrich are having a shouting match right now over who was least promiscuous. But nobody is standing around going, oh, they're a couple of whores. Right? Nobody is sexualizing them in a way that diminishes their essential humanity. They're simply talking about their behavior. Whereas
right,
if they were women,
Tom,
they would.
Tom, what's next? I mean, is that what they're inevitably looking for? Is to strip, you know, certain women and women's groups of citizenship and all rights to make up their own mind about anything and everything?
Yeah, I think so. I mean, it's what Limbaugh said. You know, his belief that the feminist movement was created so that unattractive women could have a say in society. I mean, essentially, you just heard the clip a few minutes ago. It's yeah, absolutely. Jamie in Columbia, South Carolina. Hey, Jamie.
Hey, Tom. I just wanted to suggest that maybe the reason all these right wingers hate women is because they're all so ugly, like Bill O'Reilly, Rush Limbaugh, and. Even the Republican president.
Now you're doing it.
They're all repulsive, and all the Democrats are good looking, and that's why they like women.
Yeah, well, that's an interesting one, Jamie. I don't know. I don't think so. I really don't. Janice in Huntsville, Alabama. Hey, Janice.
Yeah, how you doing, Tom?
Good. But I'll get better. What's up?
You know, as long as we're talking about the media serving the public interest. There was something on BBC News late Tuesday night that none of the media in this country has deigned or lowered themselves to report on yet. And I, for one, think it's really important. On Tuesday, Tony Blair, the outgoing PM of Britain, was in Tripoli meeting with Colonel Gaddafi, the bad boy, okay, and signed an agreement that Britain will sell Gaddafi missiles, a missile defense system, and various other armaments. They didn't go into any details. In exchange for a $900 million oil and natural gas lease. What's wrong?
Yeah, well, that's what it always comes back to, Genesis. How can we get some more money for ExxonMobil and British Petroleum and all these guys? Oh, my. 45 minutes past the hour is the Tom Hartman radio program. What's it going to take for the rest of us to realize that stupid white men are trashing our nation, our world, and our planet?
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program, the No Boring Zone, on Air America Radio. Call Tom at 866-303-2270.
Nine and a half minutes before the hour, Tom Hartman here with you.
They want to break down the white Christian male power structure, which part, and so am I.
Mm-hmm. Douglas in Atlanta, Georgia. Hey, Douglas.
Hey, Tom. Wow, so much to say, so little time to say it in. Let me say this, man. I think that we are in a civil war in this country. And you talk about psychological warfare and things like that. I think we're in a civil war in this country. The gunshots just haven't started yet. I look at the footage of what's going on down in Venezuela, and I can see that same scenario in America.
Yeah, only in reverse, perhaps, because Chavez is on the left, but an authoritarian government on the right, is that what you're talking about here?
I mean, all the things you're talking about, this fear of women, this fear of minorities, this fear, I mean, we got a whole lot of scared white men in power that are acting and behaving irrationally, that are making decisions that are not for the goodwill of all people. I think this American experiment called democracy is over.
I don't think it's over. I just think it's endangered right now, Douglas, and that's why I think we need to be having this conversation.
I think we're past the point of endangerment. I think we're past the point of discussing it. I don't write my congressman anymore. I don't send emails anymore because the things I want to say I could be prosecuted for if I were to do that. But I'm the liberal with firearms. I'm a liberal with a bad attitude, and I'm waiting. I'm just waiting for the time because, to me, you know, what happened with the Congress last week is just that was the kind of the icing on the cake for me to let me know that my vote doesn't count, that my voice doesn't matter, that my opinion is not respected. And the only thing these people are going to respond to is the ultimate show of defiance.
You really think that you can take on Black Hawk helicopters and APCs?
Me, by myself, no. Yeah. But if 20 million like-minded people decided to, yeah, I think so.
You'd have a situation like we have in Iraq right now. It would drag out for years and years. I mean, the possibility of armed conflict in the United States against our government, it's not possible.
The government is, and beyond that,
it's not desirable. I mean, you know, we went through this in the Civil War. Do you really want tens of millions of people to die? Do you really want this country to be destroyed? Why not use the political process to take it back?
What do you think is going to happen when this administration orders a nuclear strike on an American city in order to say that Iran did it so that we can go to war with Iran? I mean, tens of millions of people are going to die anyway if we don't get these people out of power, and I don't see how that's going to happen.
Well, this is why I'm, you know, without specifically addressing that conspiracy theory, which isn't all that weird because our government has talked about doing false flag operations in the past and you know, seriously considered it. So, you know, it's not outside the realm of possibility. But nonetheless, without addressing that specifically, what I'd say is that what I'm calling for is not for us to blindly support the Democratic Party. And not for us to say, oh, yeah, you know, Democratic Party, right or wrong, everything's just fine. But rather for us to infiltrate the Democratic Party and take it over. It's a far more radical agenda that I'm promoting.
I'm just tired, man. I'm tired. I'm frustrated. I'm angry.
All the more reason, instead of you know, re-oiling your gun, Douglas, all the more reason to show up at the local Democratic Party meeting and say, I want to participate. I want to be a precinct chairman. I want to be the guy who is helping make the decisions. I want to have some say in who's going to be running for this.
And they steal the damn election. You do all of that, and then they
and all the more reason to be involved in the process so you can speak out from inside experience. You can say, here's what's happening in Georgia. Let me tell you what's going on here. And let's keep in mind, Douglas, there were a lot of Democrats who voted against that legislation that so disillusioned you. And disillusioned me as well. I don't think we're to the point where we can just say to hell with it all.
Well, that's the point I'm at, and that's where I'm staying. So, yeah. Hey, man, you guys keep writing and keep you know, trying to go about it the way that you're going. But like I said, I'm sitting by and I'm just waiting.
Okay, Douglas, thanks a lot for the call. I mean, that's the bottom line. Al Gore made this point last night on I believe it was Keith Olbermann's show. He was asked, you know, well, why didn't you pursue, you know, you actually did win the presidency in 2000. You did win more votes in Florida. The Florida Supreme Court ruled that all the votes should be counted. Why didn't you pursue it after the Supreme Court decision? And Al Gore said, because between a Supreme Court decision and violent revolution, there is no middle ground. He said, we had gone as far as we could go. And we were not ready to go to violent revolution. And I really don't believe that America is ready to go to violent revolution. I really don't. Dan, nor do I think we should. Dan in San Diego, California. Hey, Dan.
Yeah, morning. Yeah, where you talk about the white male phony victimization, you know, along with the economic...
Well, actually, white males are victims. They're victims of conservative economic policies. And what these guys are trying to do is cause them to think of themselves, to think that the downside of what they're experiencing as a result of those economic policies is actually caused by minorities and by gays and in particular by women.
Right, and along with doing away with the New Deal, you always say it started under Reagan, and at the same time, this phony victimization started, and you know, with Reagan, you know, all roads go back to Reagan. And
Let's roll back all these equal opportunity laws.
As far as like how they're attacking, you know, Barbara Walters, et cetera, you know, why don't they start with people like Michelle Malkin and Ann Coulter, some of the right wing, why don't they lump them all in there at the same time? And, you know, about promiscuity, don't forget about Rush Limbaugh.
Well, they don't pick on their own. They don't pick on, Limbaugh has been married three times and all that. Yeah, and for that matter, I mean, right now you've got, as I said, you've got these two Republicans, Tom DeLay and Newt Gingrich, arguing over who had the worst promiscuity. You know, Tom DeLay saying that the affair that he had was over before he was impeaching Bill Clinton for having an affair. Whereas Newt Gingrich was actually having an affair while he was supervising the impeachment of Bill Clinton. And so that's a worse kind of adultery. Say what? 57 minutes past the hour. Tom Hartman here with you. Coming up next, Brinkley Lindsley of
the Tom Hartman Program. Transforming the world by revitalizing democracy. This is Air America Radio. Tom Hartman Program on Air America Radio, where smart people get their news.
Our quote for the day from Teddy Roosevelt, the Republican Roosevelt, President of the United States. Americanism, he said, means the virtues of courage, honor, justice, truth, sincerity, and hardihood, the virtues that made America. The things that will destroy America are prosperity at any price, peace at any price, safety first instead of duty first, the love of soft living, and the get-rich-quick theory of business. Brink Lindsey is with us. Brink Lindsey, LINDSEY.com, his website. He is the vice president for research at the Cato Institute, cato.org, and the author of a new book, The Age of Abundance, How Prosperity Transformed America's Politics and Cultures and Culture. Brink Lindsey, welcome to the program.
Tom, thanks for having me on.
Brink, your book, the sub-subtitle, Why the Culture Wars Made Us More Libertarian, and you with Cato, of course, representing a very libertarian point of view, I found it fascinating because you start out with this whole idea of Maslow's hierarchy of human needs and how, you know, once you get above safety and security and start moving toward, you know, through relationships and on toward self-actualization, that there is a change in society, and that the 60s and 70s was a time when we were above that threshold on Maslow's hierarchy of human needs, whereas largely in the history of America we weren't. And so instead of people having to concern themselves with food, you know, with feeding themselves, they had some economic security. So they started looking to other things. And this brought about what you say is actually social instability.
Certainly a lot of social upheaval. In this book, I tell the story of American society since World War II, and in particular how this advent of mass prosperity, which was something entirely new in human history. Never before had a society existed where most people weren't poor. Most people weren't directly dependent on nature for their basic needs. So this kind of radical change in the human condition, unsurprisingly, brought in its wake a whole host of revolutionary social and cultural and political changes. And so in particular, the upheavals and tumults for good and ill of the 60s and 70s, I think can't really be understood except that they were the consequences of a rich society.
Right. You write, during the 60s and 70s, the phenomenal social energies released by prosperity often seemed to threaten chaos or provoke reactions that would lead to a general retreat from liberal openness. The experience of recent years, however, has made it increasingly clear that the center did hold. Let me challenge your assumption, if you don't mind. with a little larger historical context, because you and I have written books about essentially the same thing and come to very different conclusions.
Mm-hmm.
I would submit to you that this wasn't the first time that there was such prosperity, that this was the fourth time, that the first time was after in European history, European culture, that the first time was after the Black Death killed off a third of Europeans.
Mm-hmm.
And in the three generations that followed that, the cost of labor went up so high that a middle class emerged.
Yes.
and a leisure class along with it. And that led to the Renaissance, which was a time of social upheaval, very much like the 60s and 70s, for about two generations. Similarly, in the early 1600s, as a consequence of all the gold and slaves that were being imported into Europe and all around the world, and the success of the British and Dutch trading companies, we saw a second second middle class emerge in Europe, and that led to the Enlightenment.
Yeah.
And Thomas Hobbes and John Locke and Jean-Jacques Rousseau. And then in the United States, the third one was in what we now call the United States, was in the U.S. colonies in the 1770s. And that middle class said to hell with King George and launched a revolution, and it was very much like the 60s and 70s.
Yes.
And then we didn't have a middle class from 1830 until 1940, for all practical purposes, because we went back to what I would suggest are the economic policies that libertarians are fond of, corporate control and the robber barons, and it wiped out the middle class. And so, you know, we went back below that threshold of Maslow's hierarchy of needs, and then the 60s and 70s came back. And conservatives have always looked at what happened when there was a big middle class in the 1770s and in the early 1600s and in the late 1400s. They're open about this. I mean, you know, read Russell Kirk.
Right.
They look at those times and they say social upheaval is bad. And liberals look at those times, like Thomas Jefferson, and they say social upheaval is good.
Yeah.
Isn't that the fundamental cleavage here?
I think so. Let me just say, I think your capsule historical analysis there has got a lot going on there, but I more or less agree with it. Certainly we have had cycles of prosperity and wealth creation and then a follow-up of cultural shake-up and cultural, liberation and creativity cycles throughout history.
It clamps back down again.
So there is a cyclical thing, but I think there has been a long-term, especially over the past 200 years with industrialization, a long-term secular trend towards greater wealth. And so all of these sort of creations of middle classes that you talk about were still very tiny little phenomena. I mean, you can point to there was even in the United States,
but they were culturally pivotal. That's my point.
No, of course. But the difference, and I'm not saying that the world began in 1946 or that the things that happened in the 60s had no precedent. But the difference was this was the first time that you had a mass prosperity and therefore a mass middle class and therefore a mass cultural upheaval. The Renaissance and the Enlightenment, those involved tiny groups of people. Most people were farmers scratching their living out of the soil.
No, I don't disagree. But here's the point that I want to make about that is that the Renaissance, the Enlightenment, and frankly the American Revolution all came about because of aberrations from normal laissez-faire economics. That is to say, you know, the Black Death, the finding gold in Central and South America, and slavery and free land that we could steal from the Indians here. They all came about because the normal economic order got changed by accident.
The prosperity
of the 50s, 60s, and 70s came about because Roosevelt changed the economic order by intent. It was the first middle class that was created with the Wagner Act and Social Security the WPA and things like that.
I don't know that we can untangle fundamental disagreements about 500 years of history. Bottom line, we started a wealth creation with industrialization in the 1800s, but we were a poor country. We were an agrarian country. We were rich by agrarian standards, but poor by industrial standards. We brought in millions of immigrants to man our factories, and they were dirt poor. So we were starting to create wealth through capitalism, but there wasn't enough to go around. And therefore, we had really wrenching class conflicts between the haves and the have-nots. By the 1950s, capitalism was advanced enough, technologically advanced enough, organizationally advanced enough, so that most people were capable of having middle-class lifestyles. It wasn't because of the...
Well, this is where I would disagree with you. I would say that...
The New Deal. Those things can't...
Sure, it was a 90% top marginal tax rate.
Those things can't... can't work unless the fundamental engines of capitalism are working productively enough to generate the wealth that you can then redistribute. So it happened. And I go through all of that in my book, and I talk about how the New Deal helped to consolidate this this mass middle class and this mass affluence, and then generate the kind of progressive social changes, civil rights, feminism, environmentalism, hedonism, sex, drugs, and rock and roll, all of these developments that were very popular with people left of the center, I think were made possible only by the phenomenal productivity of capitalism. So I think there's something of an irony that progressives tend to be sort of reflexively anti-market, because I think that economic growth, as evidenced in the past 60 years, has been the most progressive force in human history.
Well, I'm not anti-market. My point is that regulated capitalism works really well. And that's what we saw in the 40s, 50s, 60s, 70s, and early 80s.
And without
when Reagan came in and started deregulating capitalism, we saw the beginning of the slide back to the robber baron era. And that's, I suspect, where you and I would part company in terms of philosophy.
Right. So I would say that since these changes have happened, we've got the liberals, the people on the left, who are pessimistic about the continued economic dynamism of capitalism.
Actually, I'm quite optimistic about it if we would go back to regulating it the way we were in the 30s, 40s,
right.
50s, and 60s.
Right. You see inequality and stagnation where I see continued development of prosperity. Meanwhile, folks on the right are culturally pessimistic. They think that ever since the 60s we've been in a decline and fall, and we're heading into decadence and social breakdown. I think that most Americans buy into the libertarian-ish synthesis that has occurred here, which is that we have a very open free market economy that's much more competitive and entrepreneurial than it was back in your beloved 50s of big business, big government, and big labor. We have a huge middle class. But we also have much more progressive attitudes about race, sex, the role of women, and skepticism towards authority. So I think we've sort of combined, David Brooks talks about Bobos, bourgeois bohemians, we've combined the best of the 60s rebelliousness with the middle class values and capitalist economics that make it all possible.
It's a fascinating theory. The Age of Abundance, How Prosperity Transformed America's Politics and Culture. If you're curious about a libertarian take on all this, Cato.org, BrinkLindsey.com as well, the website. Thanks, Brink, for being with us.
Thanks for having me on.
Sure enough, 16 minutes past the hour.
You're in the Democracy Zone with Tom Hartman on Air America Radio.
Now back to the Tom Hartman Program on AirAmericaRadio.com.
Well, there's people and more people. What do they know? No. Go to work in the summer. Pays the thrills, the bills, the pills that kill.
Ain't that America?
You and me.
21 minutes past the hour. Tom Hartman here with you. And time to look at our piggies alert for the day.
£291 billion, Dr. Calculus.
Well, let me see. That would be 145 million and a half tons of the
refuse.
Yeah, refuse per every day. And by the year, let me figure, over 53 million tons of
manure?
Manure, yeah. By comparison, the pyramid of the pharaoh Cheops weighs about 690 million tons, which means that every four and three, you've got a pile of this
excrement.
Yeah.
Have you seen the bigger piggies in the starched white shed? You will find the bigger piggies stirring up the dirt. Always have clean shirts.
Oh, it's those bigger piggies you have to worry about. Christopher Rhodes writing in today's Wall Street Journal. Motorola Inc. took another step in trying to right itself by now announcing plans to more than double its job reductions and cost savings. The Schaumburg, Illinois telecommunications equipment maker said it intends to cut 7,500 jobs and reduced annualized costs by $1 billion through the end of this year and next. Long-term, Tom Meredith, the company's acting chief financial officer, says long-term sustainable profitability is and always has been Motorola's top priority. And, you know, the fact of the matter is that by law it has to be. So it's not like, you know, Motorola is some evil organization or institution. It's that the rules of the game have been reconfigured since the founding of this country to say that, you know, a business has to look out for itself first. It has to look out for its stockholders first. It has no obligation to society other than to follow the law. But no obligation generally to society. Thus, if the CEO makes 500 times what the average wage, so what? And this is where folks like Brink Lindsey and conservative economists, the Chicago School economists, the Milton Friedmans, the Tom Friedmans of the world, the free traders, the laissez-faire, everything is, you know, just throw the doors open. The people who believe that unregulated economics is somehow democracy, this is where they and I part company. Because in my opinion, absolutely unregulated economics, absolutely unregulated capitalism. Speaking of somebody who thinks that capitalism is actually a pretty good system and has made use of it very well over the last 30 years, unregulated capitalism is anti-democratic, small-d democratic. It will ultimately lead, without regulation, without things like the Sherman Antitrust Act, without things that essentially cap the ability of people to play monopoly and end up with a monopoly, end up with every piece of property on the board. Without something that prevents that from happening, that's what you're going to have. You're going to have industries that are dominated by a small handful of companies that act cooperatively, if not in collusion, at least in pseudo-collusion. They notice what each other, they raised their airfare by a buck, I guess we will. They don't have to sit around in a, you know, secret phone call, hey, we're going to raise our airfare by a dime. No. We're going to raise the price of gasoline by 15 cents this week. No, you don't have to do that. You just do it. And then everybody else says, oh, he's doing that. We can do that. You get how this works? I mean, it really is ultimately pretty straightforward stuff. That given time and given an absolute lack of regulation, if you start out with a whole bunch of little fish, a whole bunch of entrepreneurs, a whole bunch of people who are saying, oh, this is cool. I'll go out and I'll do the American dream. I'm going to start a restaurant here in my hometown. I'm going to open a little motel. We'll start with a B&B and hope to build it up to the point where it's actually a hotel downtown. I'm going to start a little store and we'll sell men's clothing or we'll sell shoes or we'll sell electronic parts or whatever. And you start out with an entrepreneurial model like we had in this country. I mean, Prior to the Reagan Revolution, you could travel around the United States and every city looked different because it was all small businesses. Strip malls were full of local companies. And then came the suspension, for all practical purposes, of the Sherman Antitrust Act. And now you could jump out of an airplane at 60,000 feet and have no, or 40,000, 20,000, 30,000, 35,000 feet, have no idea where you are when you land. And still have no idea where you are as you look around and the entire landscape is, oh, there's an Applebee's and there's a Chevron station and there's an AMC theater and there's a, and you just not, again, not to pick, and there's a Walmart, not to pick on any of these companies. They're just playing the game by the rules. But the rules have changed in such a way that the bar to entry has been raised to the point where we're no longer a nation of entrepreneurs. We're no longer a nation where people can make a living with their hands. We're no longer a manufacturing nation, and we're no longer a nation where, frankly, people can make a living with their minds, a nation of entrepreneurs. We are now a nation under the control of, under the thumb of, a very small number of very large transnational corporations who have no allegiance to the United States whatsoever, only an allegiance to their stockholders and to their profitability. And those profits, by the way, when people take them, they only pay a maximum 15% income tax on them. How weird is that? 27 minutes past the hour.
You're tuned in to the Tom Hartman Program. Fair and slightly unbalanced. This is Air America Radio.
34 minutes past the hour. Tom Hartman here with you. 1-866-303-2270, our telephone number. Rick in... Say it, Rick.
San Luis Obispo.
Thank you. The one city in America I can't pronounce. All my life, I didn't know how to pronounce it, and so I always say it wrong inside my own head. And so anyhow, hey, Rick, what's up?
Our governor has a hard time pronouncing it as well.
I'm sure.
Yeah. I want to dispute the idea that the prosperity of the 60s, you know, somehow supported the revolution, the social revolution. I mean, I'm sure it had that effect in some places, but I was part of the core group that was bringing about that revolution, and we were reacting against the establishment, against the materialism, against the pollution, and against the conformity that had been forced upon us when we were growing up in the 50s.
And against the Vietnam War. I mean, I was out there streets in the late 60s and early 70s as well, or in particular in the late 60s. And but here's the thing. I can't speak for you, but speaking for myself, you know, my dad had a good union job at a tool and die shop where we had full health insurance and he had a retirement, and we, you know, and I, to the extent that I worked my way through college, I did working in radio. I didn't graduate. My wife worked her way through college, working as a waitress in a Howard Johnson's. I mean, you could do that back then. We had economic security. We had health care security. Blue Cross Blue Shield, which was my dad's health care provider, was required by law to be a not-for-profit corporation. The hospitals in town, in Lansing, Michigan, Ingham County Hospital, was a nonprofit owned by the county. Their first priority was delivering health care. We had a social safety net. We had a base under us that gave us the luxury of being able to speak out that, frankly, I don't think the kids, young people today have.
Well, I agree with you that those things existed. The thing was, though, that the people who became the flower children and the hippies actually rejected that whole safety net, and we went without. And
I would say it was a phony going without, Bruce or Rick, because to the extent that we did that, we were doing it knowing that we could, that there was always something to fall back on. I mean, I hitchhiked across the country twice, lived in the park in San Francisco for a while and down on Fell Street off the Haight in a rent strike room. I lived in a teepee in northern Michigan for a summer. Did a variety of things that right now would be very difficult for anybody to do simply because they're not available. But also and I don't mean to characterize it as indulgent, but what's missing now is the ability to fall back on anything. And there was always that fallback position. I always knew that I could get a job. I always knew that somehow I could make it. I always knew that, you know, worse came to worse, there was something there. And I don't think that this generation of kids growing up, people in their 20s and their teens, their 20s, and even in their early 30s, feel that any longer. I don't think that reality is there any longer.
Well, I think that's true, but at the same time, we were rejecting what we saw as threatening an environmental collapse within
sure.
30 or so years, and
that's
exactly what's happening. And we began discovering alternative lifestyles, you know, such as building solar houses and growing food organically. And eating organic food.
No, I'm agreeing with all of that. What I'm saying is that the reason, in my opinion, and I may be wrong on this, but in my opinion, the reason why we're not seeing the level of social unrest or social response or reactiveness that we saw in the 60s and 70s, and even the early 80s to that, for that matter, or that we saw in the 1760s, 1770s, and 1780s, is because those were the two periods, the two unique periods of high levels of prosperity in the United States. In the 1770s, it came about as a consequence of essentially free land taken from Native Americans and slavery. Yeah, I mean, I can't justify it morally, but there it was. You had a large and strong middle class, at least among white Europeans. And they felt sufficiently safe that they could stand up and say, damn it, we're not going to put up with King George anymore. And in the 1960s, we had a middle class that came about as a consequence of Franklin Roosevelt's New Deal, and we felt safe to say, you know, damn it, we're not going to have things like this anymore, and we agree with Rachel Carlson and Carson, and we want a better nation, and we want a safe world to live in, and hell no, we're not going to go to, you know, we don't want the war, phony wars and things like that. That the ability, and you know, you look at the movements, I mean, the really tough movements were like in the 1880s and the 1890s, where you had people who had absolutely no social safety net at all, and the Wobblies were out there, and the police were shooting at them and killing them. In the early late 1920s, early 1930s, you know, the great sit-down strike in Flint, Michigan, where you had workers striking for union rights and being shot at and being fired and having nothing to fall back on, that was incredibly courageous. And I'm just not sure that we were all that courageous.
Well, I was, you know, part of the people who were just starting the protests against the Vietnam War and stuff. And I'll tell you, the rejection by society in the early 60s of the people who were letting their hair grow and their beards grow and going barefoot and just living from a sleeping bag and sleeping out, you know, for years on end often, was incredible. I mean, there was, you know, somebody wrote a book called The New Nigger, and it was all about the hippies and how they were suffering the same rejection and stuff that blacks had suffered. And, you know, I agree with you that there was that fallback position. The thing was, we rejected it, and a lot of people didn't.
Or at least we said we rejected it, and we became part of the ethos of the thinking of the time. But yeah, good point, Rick. Thank you very much. Thought provoking conversation. Rachel in Los Angeles.
Oh, hello.
Hey, Rachel.
Oh yeah, Tom. Listen, you're so wonderful, and I love the perspective you bring on everything. Thank you, thank you, thank you.
You're welcome.
But anyway, I just wanted to make a comment on your libertarian, your Cato Institute guest.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, he, of course, claiming that it was American capitalism that created the middle class, that had nothing to do with the social programs, you know, blah, blah, blah. Mm-hmm. And then he based it all just on America and American history. And you know, we should just be pointing out, hey, look at all of Europe. They've got a much stronger middle class.
Well,
you know,
the stronger middle class,
you know.
And yeah, the strongest middle class in the world is in Sweden, which most of these guys would characterize as a socialist country.
I lived in Iceland for a year back in the 70s. I know the Scandinavian countries are astounding. Highest literacy rate in the world. No violent crime, no poverty.
Yeah.
It's
incredible. Absolutely right, Rachel, and thank you for making the point and well made. David in how do you pronounce that one, David?
Mukilteo.
Okay, great.
Yeah, just watching.
Yeah, you wanted to disagree with me. What's up?
Yeah, I think there's two main things that the collectivists underestimate about
the collectivists. Who's a collectivist?
Well, the collectivist mentality, that everyone working together for society.
You're talking about like George Washington and Ben Franklin and those guys.
Well, whoever had it, those people didn't, but I.
Well, they organized society. I mean, it's
society will organize itself if you let it. But anyway, there's two main things that you way underestimate. There's a lot of things, but the first is competition. The invisible hand, Adam Smith's invisible hand, and the power of that to drive down prices and increase quality of products, which increases the standard of living of everyone.
You'll recall that Adam Smith's reference, he only referenced the phrase invisible hand once in The Wealth of Nations in 1776, and that was in the context of it being a warning.
That I don't know what you've read, but the invisible hand has been referenced a zillion.
He used that phrase once in the entire book, and broadly the context of it was that that it can be a corrective, but also that the point that he was making in The Wealth of Nations is that nations not only have an obligation to interact with each other in ways that increase their wealth, but also to limit their interactions with each other in ways that retain their wealth. you know, his famous example of the, you know, one country makes, as I recall, cheese, one country makes wool, one country makes wine, let's all trade with each other, we can all have wine, cheese, and wool. That's great. But what happens if two of those three countries make cheese? Then it becomes incumbent on one of them to start protecting their domestic cheese industry.
Why would it? Because they want to continue to have
the ability to make cheese.
Yeah, but you're going to, doing that, you're going to increase the quality, the price of the product, and decrease the quality if you isolate.
That's right, but it's going to work to the benefit of society. That's why Adam Smith titled the book "The Wealth of Nations."
Possibly,
it'll reduce the wealth of the nation.
That's the very thing that isolationism does. It's going to increase. How can that increase the wealth of the nation? The wealth of the nation, you have to be referring to the standard of living.
No, I'm talking about overall wealth. The wealth of the United States has been decreased since 1980.
Well, that doesn't, the standard of living of the people in the nation.
No.
And if you
the wealth is the aggregate of the value of goods and services owned by the nation. We in the United States now, we don't even own much of our nation any longer.
That's not the true wealth. The true wealth is the standard of living of the individual. The individual.
Well, we have different measurements. Yeah. All right. We have different measurements. 45 minutes past the hour.
The Tom Hartman Program, where smart people get their news. This is Air America Radio.
Because you're mine, I walk the line. I keep a close watch on this heart of mine.
Unless your name's Tom DeLay.
I keep my eyes wide open all the time.
Unless you're Newt Gingrich.
I keep the ends out for the tie that binds.
Unless you're Bob Barr.
Mine, I want the
unless you're Congressman Livingston. All those Republicans who are impeaching Bill Clinton. All getting a little on the side. Amazing. Ellen Ryder with the Talk Radio News Service on the line with us. Hey, Ellen.
Good day. Well, the president today made a speech at the Ronald Reagan International Center talking about what he was going to do in his G8 meetings. And he talked about climate change, poverty, disease, particularly with his big AIDS initiative. And at the same time, and I can go through a chapter and verse if you would like, at the same time he was doing that, his very own ambassador to the Sudan said these economic sanctions on the Sudan was to send a message to the Sudanese government to start behaving differently when they deal with their own people. And then he also he gave a briefing on this, that he felt that sanctions on large oil firms would be extreme.
Right, but he went on to say these sanctions are not really sanctions, and they also exempted the two largest Chinese companies that trade with the Sudan, so that, by way of saying,
National Petroleum Company and the Gum Arabic something or other. Right.
He said, we're not going to upset our trading partners. This is more show than substance, frankly, in my opinion.
So a lot of what I have two theories, and I know you like to hear my analysis. One analysis is that he wants to set himself looking up good for his buddies at the G8 because there is a collegial issue and effort around that. And the other thing that I think that he's very interested in doing is he's gotten such bad press that he's looking around. He's got, less than 2 years in office, and he is maybe looking at his legacy. But in any case, his legacy is backhanded because he's saying one thing and then something else happens. Meanwhile, the NASA administrator today, I mean, you got to love this guy. He's the gift that keeps on giving. Michael Griffin was asked about global warming. He said that he's not sure it's a problem can be wrestled with. Now, if you recall, NASA has been the one that when some of their scientists began to talk about global change, some of the political appointees, some of them young people in their late 20s, actually put the real kibosh on the science that was coming out of NASA. So we thought it was maybe some, Yahoo got his instructions from the Bush communications office, but obviously this is from the top down.
Yeah. Michael Griffin, any relation to Tim Griffin, do you know?
Our buddy Mr. Tim Griffin, who people tell me makes Karl Rove look like minor potatoes when he was at the RNC in the political director's job.
Right, although he's going to, and is, I, if we're talking about the same person, the guy who got the gig as the as the prosecutor, as federal prosecutor down in Arkansas, and is going to resign in the next day or two?
He did resign.
Oh, he did resign.
Well, he handed in his resignation. He may not leave for a couple weeks, but he did resign. And, of course, all thoughts are that he is going to go to the new campaign of Fred Thompson.
And the guy, and this is the guy who, according to Monica Goodling, was responsible, was alleged to be responsible for the caging operations during the Bush 2004 election campaign. That would be the illegal election fraud that stole the election of 2004.
Oh, yeah. No, this guy, and I know this from Republicans that I'm close to, and you've met some of them, is about as bad. I think he makes Karl Rove look like a day at the beach, frankly.
Really?
Really? Yeah.
That's pretty tough. That's pretty tough.
No,
to do.
Apparently this guy is just as bad as you get him. Mm. And this is who's going to Fred Thompson's campaign.
Yeah, or at least there's talk about it. I mean, we don't know
if
this is coming.
We don't know, but we do know there's been some communication. And although he was only because he it turned out sort of to be a recess appointment, he only had like two more months left.
Yeah. Well, I was wondering where the leak came from. Was this Griffin leaking this to the press in an effort to rehabilitate his own image and make himself appealing to a future employer, or was this Fred Thompson and his campaign staff leaking it to the press in as a way of saying, wink, wink, nod, nod, we're the heir apparent to the Bush wing, to the George Bush Jr. wing of the Republican Party, the Steele elections wing of the Republican Party, the most corrupt and corruptible.
Well, I mean, anything is possible, and I don't think we're going to know until the campaign books are written and people start talking. I mean, speaking of campaign books, do you believe Shrum's book?
I haven't read it.
They're leaking.
I wouldn't
everything.
Believe.
Well, they're leaking things about what he said about gay people, about what he wanted to do with Edwards and the vote on Iraq. I mean, this guy is like, as we used to call in mental health, a leaky faucet.
Yeah, Bob Shrum, the guy who was basically in charge of, what, seven or eight Democratic presidential elections that he blew?
Yeah, Dumb Shrum, we call him in the business.
Oh, my. Poor guy.
I know. He's trying to sell a book. I should be supportive.
Yeah, yeah. We all of us who have written books should be, I suppose. But it's Tom DeLay's trying to sell a book, too. I have a hard time being supportive. At a certain point. Anything else happening in Washington, D.C. that we need to know about?
Well, I mean, the only other thing that, of course, is happening that my brother's very involved in and is this issue of the Guantanamo detainee who committed suicide, forced to take his own life in the last year.
Yeah. Any idea who this guy was? Was he some low-level slug, or was he one of the...
released his name publicly. I could be wrong, but I don't think that they have. Apparently they are now saying that the Rear Admiral who runs it is saying that who runs Guantanamo is saying that this is an act of war. Somebody commits suicide is an act of war. Now, I understand kamikaze, et cetera, but a suicide in a cell is an act of war. I don't know what your definition of an act of war is, but that's
well. Then we've got a lot of wars around the United States because suicide in prison is a fairly common thing, actually. You know, despair in prison.
Increasing.
Yeah, yeah, and I guess the main thing is that a lot of these guys have been trying to commit suicide from the get go, and the government has been force feeding them and tying them down and doing everything they can to keep them from committing suicide because it looks bad. So maybe that's the act of war, making us look bad.
I guess so.
Could be. Ellen Ratner with the Talk Radio News Service, talkradionews.com. Ellen, thanks for dropping in today.
Thank you.
Good talking with you. 57 minutes past the hour at the Tom Hartman Radio Program. Coming up next, Kathleen Kennedy Townsend.
Exposing the con in conservative. This is the Tom Hartman Program on Air America Radio. The Tom Hartman Program on Air America Radio. Talk radio for the rest of us.
Well, we know that the economy under the Bush administration, while it has grown somewhat, has grown at about half the rate it did during the 8 years of the Clinton administration. And, in fact, at a lower rate than it did during the recoveries during the Roosevelt administration, the Eisenhower administration, the Kennedy administration, the Johnson administration, the Nixon administration. In fact, it has the rate of economic growth in the United States has been slower than for any post-war administration. Now it's come to a screeching halt. This from, I believe it's the Associated Press. The economy nearly stalled in the first quarter of growth, slowing to a pace of just 0.6%. That's for a quarter. It was the worst 3 months showing in over 4 years. A new reading in the gross domestic product released by the Commerce Department Thursday as today showed that economic growth in the January through March quarter was much weaker. Government statisticians slashed by more than half their first estimate of a 1.3% growth rate for the quarter. The main culprits for the downgrade? The bloated trade deficit. You'll recall just a moment ago we were talking about free trade. Now, is that wonderful or is that a disaster? The bloated trade deficit and businesses cutting investment in supplies of the goods they hold in inventories, which would mean that they're anticipating that things are going to get worse. If you're a retail store and you figure, okay, in the course of a month I can sell six of this item, but if things slow down, I'll only sell five, then you reduce inventory. The fancy economic way of saying that is that you reduce inventory. For nearly a year, the article continues, the economy has been enduring a stretch of subpar economic growth due mostly to a sharp housing slump. This because we have an economy where people have been required, for all practical purposes, to use their homes as piggy banks to be able to just keep their head above water. Why? Because of conservative economic policies, because these insane trade policies, because we've done away with tariffs, because the unions are under assault and have been ever since 1981. 26 years of war on the middle class and working people in the United States coming now home to roost. And it could be just the beginning. new people, filed for unemployment last month. This is just, it doesn't seem like there's much good news. The sour housing market also restrained overall economic activity. Investment in home building was cut by 15.4% on an annualized basis in the first quarter. That wasn't as deep a cut as the 17% annualized drop initially estimated. Wasn't as severe as the 19% annualized drop seen in the final quarter of last year. See, this is a trend. It's just an ongoing, it's like a slow-motion train wreck, our economy. And, you know, we have to ask ourselves, you know, where is this going to go? Where is it going to lead to? We'll talk about that a little bit more in a few minutes. Right now, Kathleen Kennedy Townsend is with us. She has a new book out. She's the eldest daughter of Robert F. Kennedy and the author of a new book, Failing America's Faithful, How Today's Churches Are Mixing God with Politics and Losing Their Way. Kathleen Kennedy Townsend, welcome to the program.
Oh, it's such a pleasure to be with you.
Well, thank you. I'm very glad to have you on. You know, Thomas Jefferson was concerned that if the religious ever got into power in government, it would be a disaster for democracy. James Madison was concerned that if government ever started giving money to churches, it would be a disaster for the churches because it would corrupt the churches. Each thought the other was being paranoid. It looks like they're both right.
Well, there, it absolutely is right. I mean, it's really a problem, of course, if the government gets too much engaged in religious affairs because power corrupts, and it's totally clear that when it happens, people lose faith in religion because they see how corrupt it can become, which I think is so much what happened in Europe. People saw the abuses of religion and state in Europe, and as a result, Europe is one of the least religious places in the world. In contrast, in the United States, where we've made a real effort to keep things apart, there is a religious vitality.
Yeah, religion has flourished. In Europe, you had Cromwell in the 1600s, the early 1600s, imposing a Puritan state on England. They still haven't recovered from that. And you had the Catholic Church controlling most of Central Europe up until the 1849 was the Italian Revolution, as I recall.
Yeah.
For most of the 16th and 17th centuries, yeah, or 17th and 18th centuries.
Yeah, and people got and you saw what happened after Solidarity. The Catholic Church was very strong in Poland during the Soviet dictatorship, because mm-hmm. the Catholic Church was seen as the
way to rebel, the way to, you know, hold firm to the to one's culture. And yet when the when they got rid of the Soviet Union, when they were overthrown it, when the Pope wanted to impose, you know, sort of a Catholic theocracy in Poland, people rebelled against that. They said, no, that's not what they were for.
Yeah,
so
it's
dangerous in all fronts.
You talk in your book.
Go ahead.
Well, in your book, Chapter 3, God's Work Must Be Truly Our Own, the Catholic Church's Tradition of Social Justice. And then from there, you even go into the Protestant tradition of social justice and progressivism. Talk a little bit about that.
Well, what I've argued in this book is that, you know, there, of course, as we talked earlier, there does definitely need to be a separation of church and state. But there are great people of faith, people who believe in social justice, which have been at the core of every social justice movement in our country. And I thought that what has happened in the last 40 years is that tradition has been lost and left out. The Catholic Church was very prominent in, for instance, the union movement, in the anti-war movement during the Vietnam War, and in other social justice movements in the late 19th century, fairness for immigrants, you know, more schools, more orphanages, more places for the better treatment for prisoners. And yet what we see today is that the faith community, the loud faith community, seems to be only focused on three issues, you know, abortion, same-sex marriage, and stem cell research. And what I say in my book, which is why I wrote it, that's really a misuse of faith. It's a shrinking, you know, they've shrunk God, and we should reclaim a God that cared about the great issues, not just a few narrow ones.
Yeah, and you speaking as somebody who was raised Catholic, I'm speaking as somebody who was raised Protestant. We both, I love it. In page 157 of your book, Moses, in your chapter, Moses didn't have fakes yet. You quote Matthew 25, which is one of, you know, I think the Beatitudes in Matthew 25 are the entire essence of Christianity. And, you know, it's where Jesus said, you feed the hungry, heal the sick, and, right. and as you've done to the least of these, my brothers, you've done unto me. And then the next page you say the religious left has been all but silent, while conservatives have redefined faith and values in their own image.
Thank you for reading so carefully. But that is, I think the religious left has been afraid. They're fearful about speaking out, and they don't speak out, which has been, I think, bad for religion and bad for the left. And I couldn't agree more that I think, you know, the central part of Christianity is what do we do for the least among us, which we don't hear about. You know, people talk about. So I think that we need to reclaim that strong tradition. And Protestantism, your own faith, which I write about, you know, was really important in a sense of it gave us protest against government. It gave us a sense that we're all equal in front of God, and it gave us a belief that we are, you know, that we're on earth to perfect it, to make it better. It's a great tradition, and I don't hear it. I do hear once, you know, people talk about Martin Luther King, they remember that, but they've forgotten that so much part of American history was, you know, a Protestant history of protest and improvement and opening the doors to people who were not always popular.
Mm-hmm. We're talking with Kathleen Kennedy Townsend. Her new book, Failing America's Faithful, How Today's Churches Are Mixing God with Politics and Losing Their Way. Kathleen, we have just a little less than a minute left. How do we bring about these values in our society without creating a theocracy?
Well, the great thing about a progressive Christianity or progressive Judeo-Christian tradition is that they've lasted 2,000 years or even longer because they're universal values. The idea that we're all equal is a universal value. The idea that we should care for the least among us is a universal value. So we can speak to our own religious groups in maybe in ways that they particularly understand. But I have to tell you, when John Kennedy said that on God's earth, on this earth, God's work must truly be our own.
Mm-hmm.
Nobody said, well, that's just a Catholic idea. They understood that that is what it means to be human, to do God's work, to see that we're here for a greater purpose and to create a more just society is really part of the glory of life on earth.
Yeah, it's the essence of spirituality as well, and it should become the essence of religion.
That's
Kathleen,
right.
Kathleen Kennedy Townsend, her book, Failing America's Faithful. Thanks so much for being with us.
Hey, Tom, good to be with you, and thanks for reading so carefully.
You're welcome.
It. You're terrific.
16 minutes past the hour.
The Tom Hartman Program. Viagra for your brain. On Air America Radio. Call 866-303-2270.
Now back to the Tom Hartman Program on AirAmericaRadio.com.
Well, I know what's right. I got just one life. In a world that keeps on pushing me around, but I stand my ground and I won't back down.
21 minutes past the hour. Tom Hartman here with you. Lou in Fayetteville, Arkansas. You're on the air. Hey, Lou. Thanks for calling. What's up?
How you doing, Tom? So you had a young man call a little bit earlier that I got a little concerned when I listened to him. Who was so discouraged that he's actually talking about some type of violence or this. But, you know, and I'm not opposed to violence. I spent 38 months flying around the tail end of a bomber. I was a policeman for 20 years. But there's senseless violence and there's necessary violence. And right now is not the time for senseless violence. But I'm very disappointed, too, because I worked very hard to make Arkansas a blue state. And when I see my senator or these other senators backing down, you know, principle is far more important than actually winning sometimes. And I don't think they're showing principle. And I think, I was so discouraged, I actually went down and changed my party affiliation to independent because I did not want my name associated with a bunch of cowards. But
I've gotten a startling number of emails from people saying essentially the same thing.
Yeah.
I said I've got a lot. I mean, I'm hearing from a lot of people saying the same thing that they're abandoning the Democratic Party. And my concern is that if we all abandon the Democratic Party, that we're letting go of this giant machine that can be very powerful and very useful, and that what we should be doing is redoubling our efforts to take over the Democratic Party.
Well, let me explain something. 50% of the American people are independents. This last election was not won by Democrats. It was won by Democrats, Republicans wanting their true Republicans wanting their party back, Libertarians, Green Party, and 50% of the American people do not associate with either the Democrat or the Republican Party. Now, I write letters to the editor. In fact, I've had over 150 published in just the last 3 years. It's a constant thing. And what I'm doing now is asking members of both parties who really believe that we're going the wrong direction to not only become independent, but to write their parties and tell them why. Hey, could I mention a blog?
Sure.
Okay. www.lewsviews.com, LewsViews.com, and I've got tips in there on how I managed to get so many letters published. But
okay.
I think,
I said okay.
But I really believe it's time that if they start bombarding these letters to the editor, bombarding their congressman and senator, and just ask them one thing, stand up, have a little courage. You know, we've got 95 of the same Senate that was there before the election. So, you know, I can partially understand that, but I cannot.
No, I get your point, Lou, and it's well said, and we need to be taking it back. We need to take back the Senate. And I've said my piece. Stuart in Seacliff, New York. Hey, Stuart.
Hey, Tom. Thanks for taking my call. Two quick points. Well, one, first of all, I want to say that you're the man. That's all I got to say. And I'm a proud union man. It's local one stagehand in New York City. And I feel fortunate that I work in a city and in an industry show business that is still strong with union strong. And the other point is Harley-Davidson, the company Harley-Davidson, the history of Harley-Davidson is a perfect example of everything you talk about economics, labor, you know, a family-built business until they were taken over by AMF, and then it kind of dragged them down. But some of the founding sons and shareholders bought themselves back and rebuilt themselves into the strongest, one of the biggest motorcycle makers in the world. And part of that was due to they needed help against Japanese competition So they had the government instituted a tariff on Japanese motorcycles over 700 cc's, and that's what really helped them until they, you know, they finished rebuilding from the AMF takeover. And,
right.
You know, it's a perfect example. Of course, now they were having problems with their unions, and the unions fought back by saying, you know, we helped. We were there to bring you guys back. And I'm not sure what's going on with the machine.
Well, everybody is suffering. Well, yeah. What's happening right now, Stuart, not specifically with Harley-Davidson, but right across the board, is that everybody is suffering from the consequence of this, you know, ongoing 26-year war against the middle class that was declared by Ronald Reagan and is continuing to be waged by conservatives nationwide. Adam, driving in Connecticut. Hey, Adam.
Hey, Tom, that's awesome talking to you. I actually wanted to point out... What Kathleen
Kennedy Townsend
pointed out about Poland, because I happen to grow up in Poland, and she said that after overthrow of communism, Poland rejected the rule
theocracy,
the theocratic rule of Catholic Church. And the problem we have in Poland, although I agree with her, everything that she says, but this particular problem that Poland has right now is that we have a horrible, horrible government right now led by a Polish Family League, which is the equivalent of a right-wing Catholic, religious right in America. You know what I mean?
So it's so the major party is sort of like the Republican Party, only it's been taken over by the Catholic Church?
Yeah,
in Poland?
Yes, exactly.
Yeah.
And
Poland's a predominantly Catholic country.
Yeah, yeah, and it's been unfortunate, and we were experiencing like really draconian laws, you know, limiting women's reproductive rights, and it's just bad. So that's all I wanted.
This is your home for progressive talk. AirAmericaRadio.com.
Yeah.
And the moon is the only light we'll see. So I won't be afraid. No, I won't be afraid. Just as long as you stand by me.
As Ben Franklin said, as they stood there in front of John Hancock to sign the Declaration of Independence, as he and John Adams and Thomas Jefferson, and as I recall, it was George Mason. The painting is my screensaver on my computer. Presented the Declaration. He said, "We have to hang together, otherwise we shall surely hang separately." So, Joan McCarthy, it's time for our Best of the Rest of the News segment, where we bring in some of the best news and blog sites out there on the internet and in the internets, and explore what's going on in the news and what's coming up in the news. Joan McCarthy is with us with the Daily Kos. Hey, Joan. Great to have you with us. Thank you. You're a contributing editor at the Daily Kos. And Isaiah Poole is with us. He's the executive editor of TomPaine.com, www.TomPaine.com. Hey, Isaiah, welcome.
Thank you.
Glad to have you both here with us. Joan, what's at the top of the news in your mind, the most important stories running over at Daily Kos right now?
It's always the ongoing story of Iraq. And today it was Joe Lieberman's Memorial Day visit to Iraq and his...
Mm.
Yeah.
Yeah. Where he bought a pair of sunglasses, wasn't that cool?
He bought his sunglasses. They were... surprisingly not rose-colored, but he still sees progress.
Yeah.
He still does. We're having a positive effect, he says, in Baghdad.
But at least some soldiers confronted him on this.
They did confront him. I don't know that they got to say exactly what they wanted to say or in as strong a terms, and I certainly doubt he really heard them, but they had the opportunity.
Yeah. Interesting. And Isaiah Poole over at TomPaine.com, what are you seeing as the top stories on Tom Paine right now?
There are a couple of interesting stories that have caught our eye. One of the there is a recall of some feed, livestock and fish feed that was
produced by an Ohio company that contained melamine. And
this is the stuff from China.
Yeah, except that, you know, again, this was feed that was produced by an American firm, not a Chinese firm, that put the melamine in the feed as sort of a binder, sort of to help the feed stay together as it's fed to the cows and the pigs and so on. The Food and Drug Administration, which is supposed to be policing this stuff, didn't even know that this stuff was being used until May 18th of this year. They decided not to order the recall because supposedly there is not enough of this stuff in the food to cause human health concerns, but the firms did a recall anyway. So the question is, we've been running a continuing series of items related to what one of our bloggers, Rick Perlstein, calls E. coli conservatism. The fact that you can put people in government who don't believe in government, they gut federal agencies that are supposed to be protecting the public interest, and therefore the public interest is not protected.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and we should just add, melamine is high in amino acids. It's in, you know, usually when things end with amine, it means that they are, you know, they are an amino acid, or they contain a lot of amino acids. And the way that you test for protein content is you look for amino acids. And so by adding melamine, even though it's not an edible amino acid, by adding this to for example, wheat gluten, it causes it to test as having a higher protein content than it would normally have. And so it's a cheap way of boosting the protein content of things like wheat gluten, for example. Gluten is a protein that are sold as protein supplements or as binders. You know, some proteins are sticky. And so, again, this is what we're seeing here is the free market at work.
Right.
The downside of the free market at work.
Exactly.
Interesting. Interesting.
Coming from the Chinese companies, we knew or we think we know that they were putting the melamine in to give that artificial protein boost. Was that the case with the American company as well?
No, it was, they were simply using it as a binding agent. It wasn't, the reporting that we've seen, that it wasn't done so much to artificially boost protein content. It's just to make it just look better.
Well, that's interesting. Well, you know, yeah, the proteins are sticky. I mean, if you take the primary protein out of milk, which is called casein, and you can buy it by the pint or by the few ounces at a time, it's called Elmer's Gluol. And so, you know, proteins tend to be sticky. Joan McCarter, over at DailyKos.com, the contributing editor there. What do you see coming down the road? What are the stories that you see showing up at the Daily Kos right now that you think are perhaps harbingers of bigger things to come, or things that perhaps are not being really attended to by any of us, or by most of us, or certainly by the mainstream media, that we should all be paying more attention to?
Big thing I see coming down the pike and certainly occupying us through September, in addition to Iraq, of course, is the Farm Bill. Huge, huge piece of legislation that has concerns for progressives throughout, from aid to farmers to fair trade, nutrition programs for the poor, conservation measures, agricultural research, energy policy, forestry, all of these things, rural development, that should have a huge, huge interest for progressives because it's, you know, in the Ag Committee and because it's the Farm Bill, it just doesn't seem all that sexy to us. So I think that's sort of one of the overlooked stories right now.
And I'm even reading news stories in the science literature about a concern that a rapid shift to biofuels will reduce the amount of cropland available. We're talking worldwide here, not just in the United States, reduce the levels of croplands available and perhaps lead to things like famine.
It's
or at
true.
Least an increase in an increase in the price of food and thus, you know, really whacking poor people in terms of their ability to eat.
We're already seeing it to an extent. I saw a report last week about the shortage of corn in Mexico because they get so much of the corn that they use to eat from the United States. Much of that corn is being shifted now into biofuels. So we're already seeing the impact of that.
Now, the flip side of that might be that if the price of corn goes up in Mexico, then once again it becomes profitable for family farmers to be family farmers, and so they might leave the big cities and the slums that they've moved into as they've been pushed off their family farms and go back to family farming. Or have they already lost their land now? Some big transnationals come in and bought it up, and they're growing, you know, cotton or something there.
That I'm not sure of, but I would bet it was the second.
Yeah, because it's interesting. Well, I mean, you know, one of the comments a lot of people make is that, well, you've got a lot of people coming to the United States looking for work because they've been forced off the farm because we subsidize corn.
Right, right. The other part of this story that we have to keep an eye on is same old in Congress, even with the new boss, Nancy Pelosi. There's Colin Peterson from Minnesota is chairman of the Ag Committee and has a pretty draconian approach, much as the old bosses did, in putting this bill together. And we've got some indication that Pelosi is supporting him in doing this, in not offering more progressive amendments and not allowing them to come to the floor should they not make it into the bill in committee. So that's something we need to keep an eye on, too. We've got to make sure that our representatives stay our representatives.
Well, and this all tracks back again to Ronald Reagan suspending the Sherman Antitrust Act, allowing these big ag companies to become much, 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 much bigger, which led to the farm crisis of the 1980s, where small farmers were getting wiped out because the big ag companies were coming in and driving down local prices to the point where small farmers were going bankrupt, then buying their land from them and saying, oh, would you like to work for us now? And, you know, I have a lot of friends in Michigan where I grew up who, you know, grew up in farm families, and they're still working the same land. They just don't own it anymore.
Right. They're sharecroppers now. We have a lot of them here in Idaho. I'm visiting in Idaho this week. A lot of potato farmers here in Idaho are sharecroppers, essentially, to ConAgra.
Indeed. Isaiah Poole, I'm wondering, executive editor TomPaine.com, over at TomPaine.com, what are the stories that you're seeing coming down the road that you think are really in need more attention?
Well, we're keeping our eye on the energy bill, and I think we're seeing some of the same disturbing parallels on the energy side that we've just talked about in terms of the farm bill. You have guys like John Dingell, who is now the chairman of the House Energy Committee, who's very beholden to the auto manufacturers.
Right, he's a Republican from Michigan, from the Detroit area.
Actually, a Democrat.
Democrat. Yeah, I'm sorry. Thank you. Yeah.
But I remember. And you have Democrats who are also in leadership positions who are very tied to the coal industry. So that makes it very difficult for environmental organizations and other progressive organizations to move forward policies that will advance sustainable and more pollution-free energy alternatives.
Right. They're talking about coal, liquid coal now?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. And again, you have Pelosi and Reid, who are not taking as firm a stand as many of us would like.
Yeah, ultimately, at the end of the day, I think the solution to this whole thing is to get the money out of politics. We need to go to publicly funded elections, but that's a whole other rant. Joan McCarter with the Daily Kos, dailykos.com, and Isaiah Poole with TomPaine.com. Thank you both for being with us today.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Great, great speaking with both of you. It's 45 minutes past the hour on the Tom Hartman radio program right here on Air America Radio.
Hartman Program, transforming the world by revitalizing democracy. This is Air America Radio.
Let me say thank you to those who love many. Let me say thank you to those who still fight fair.
Nine and a half minutes before the hour, Tom Hartman here with you. Let's step into the Wayback Machine for just 1 minute. Here is Frank Zappa debating Robert Novak on Crossfire in the mid-1980s.
The biggest threat to America today is not communism. It's moving America toward a fascist theocracy. And everything that's happened during the Reagan administration is steering us right down that pipe.
Oh, Mr. Zappa, do you really think? I mean, all kidding aside, in this country, with the permissiveness that we are moving toward a fascist theocracy, anything goes.
We are, but,
you know, I mean, do you think things like this would have ever been permitted?
Give me that famous smile again.
When we were kids, you're about my age, maybe a little
45.
Younger. I'm 55. Do you think when I was a kid that they would permit songs like that to be sold? I mean, permissiveness is the game. I mean, you're not really serious if you're saying we're going toward a fascist theocracy.
That's right, we are.
Wait a minute.
In what way? Give me one example
of a fascist theocracy.
When you have a government that prefers a certain moral code derived from a certain religion, and that moral code turns into legislation to suit one certain religious point of view, and if that code happens to be very, very right-wing, almost toward Attila the Hun...
Well, then you are an anarchist. Every form of civil government is based on some kind of morality, Frank.
Morality in terms of behavior, not in terms of theology.
Frank Zappa. May he rest in peace. The late Frank Zappa. Back in mid-1980s, more or less about 20 years ago, on Crossfire. Amazing. Alice in Olympia, Washington. Hey, Alice, welcome to the program.
Hi, Tom. I love your show. I just want to submit a different opinion about the revolution of the 60s and 70s. That the children born after World War II did not finish the revolution. We didn't get to see what they would have created because it was interrupted and suppressed by the introduction of drugs everywhere in the country, suddenly in 1964. I was in high school in 1963, and there were none, absolutely none. Mm-hmm. And the drugs didn't cause the revolution. The drugs destroyed it. Even Bob Wright, who was head of the Green Berets, said that the Vietnam War brought drugs to this country in body bags, even out of...
See, I would argue that would be true of the hard drugs of heroin and speed, and I remember going back to the Haight-Ashbury in the early 70s, and I'd lived in that area in 67 for the summer of 67 or 68. I guess it was the summer of 68. And it had completely deteriorated. I mean, it had become basically meth alley. It had become a, you know, high crime area, dangerous. And I would agree with you on the hard drugs. On the other hand, I'm of the opinion that psychedelics and pot actually promoted rebellion.
Well, I think that there was a whole... I mean, I have training in astrology, so I know that there was a whole generation of people that were born, all of us, with certain aspect that determined sort of, or what came first, the chicken or the egg. But
sure.
We came in with a lifelong preference. And I don't think the revolution is over yet, Tom, thank God. I think we're people who rejected certain old values that just don't work, that stifle people, and that we still have in our nature a love of a more natural life, and we're older and wiser now, and we just might have what it takes to see the human race through hard times that could be ahead.
Well, from your lips to God's ears, Alice, and hopefully you're absolutely right, and also that the revolution isn't over yet. Eric in Southbridge, Massachusetts. Hey, Eric.
Tom, love your program. Hey, I wanted to tell you a tale that might shed some light on that gentleman who thought it was time for armed rebellion, and your opinion seems to be that it's unlikely to succeed and unlikely to happen. In 1969,
or if it did happen, and even if it did succeed, I suspect that it would be more like the French Revolution than like the American Revolution, because there's not an armed occupying force right now, and so we would be eating our own. I'm very concerned about that.
I don't disagree, but I wanted to tell you this small tale. When I was in the peace demonstration October 1969, and somewhere in the 80s or something, I was talking about old times with a friend of mine, and he'd been a Vietnam vet. He was a very, very much military type, and I mentioned I was there, and he said he was too. And I said, really? You don't seem to be the type. And he said, well, I was manning a 30-caliber machine gun in an attack helicopter. And the idea was, the contingency plan was that if any of the protesters, or the, you know, the bulk of the protesters started to invade one of the federal buildings, there would have been a slaughter. And that was,
well, look at what happened at Kent State. And now we have the audio. Ready, aim, fire.
I can tell you what happened in as a result of Kent State. All the colleges closed because people went home to get their guns, and so those times were you know, in the end, were not as peaceful as some people thought. Anyway, I think it was very close in October 1969, and it could be very close again. I would even say more so. I think it's we're more volatile now than we were then.
You know, there are certainly a lot of right-wingers out there. There's an entire movement. I've been a guest on some of their radio shows, particularly some of the shortwave shows that they do with, of the survivalist movements. And it's interesting to talk to these guys because they think of themselves as the last real, true, absolute patriots. And they're storing up as much ammunition as they can. I mean, they're out there in Montana and well, not just Montana, you know, every state in the Union. They're out there stocking up and getting a year's worth of food and the whole bit and, you know, big militia movements. And, you know, and I don't know. I don't think it's going to come from the left if it happens, but we'll see. We'll see. Something we can continue the conversation on as time goes on. Coming up tomorrow, Anything Goes Friday. Of course, brunch with Bernie, Senator Bernie Sanders here. And we'll be taking your calls throughout the afternoon. Next week, I'm in Croatia. It's going to be a hoot, but I'll be coming in live at least 2 days out of the week. Peter B. Collins will be here the rest of the time. And don't forget, my friends, democracy begins with you. Activism begins with you. Tag, you're it. See you tomorrow.
This is the Tom Hartman Program on Air America Radio. For exclusive Tom Hartman archives and more information, visit us online at airamericaradio.com.